This is a download from the BBC. To find out more and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk.
Hello. Did the Archbishop of Canterbury goof, or did BBC News mislead, taking his words out of context?
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has spoken out about the scandal surrounding Catholic paedophile priests with a blunt declaration that the Church in Ireland has lost all credibility. He was speaking during an edition of Radio 4's Start the Week programme, which is to be broadcast on Monday.
When Dr. Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, talked to Andrew Marr on Monday's edition of Start the Week, he made what he thought were some unexceptional remarks. BBC News disagreed and ran what many of our listeners think were hyped up and distorted reports 2 days before the actual programme was broadcast. And they asked if the reason was to publicise the upcoming programme. In feedback this week, the deputy head of the BBC newsroom responds to some very critical comments of his output. Also coming up, Eugene Terblanche was a white supremacist, but after he was beaten to death in South Africa, was it appropriate to gloat about his demise and express delight that it was a slow one?
I have to say, when I knew I was coming on a programme like this, it's a gift from God to have one of the world's greatest white supremacists be killed.
That was comedian Omid Jalili, who, with Marina Hyde of The Guardian, appeared on Broadcasting House to review the papers and, some listeners think, to celebrate the brutal murder of the Boer leader. And yes, it's on and they're off. The election is finally to be held on May the 6th. Can listeners last the distance? We start with a programme that has been greatly praised and has also been the subject of much controversy. Monday's edition of Start the Week was recorded at Lambeth Palace and featured writer Philip Pullman, comedian David Baddiel, and, of course, the palace's present occupant, Dr. Rowan Williams. Robert Theobald from Ashford in Kent contacted us, delighted with what he'd heard.
The mix of invited guests promised an invigorating, erudite, educating and uplifting discussion. And with Andrew Marr's excellent cheering, that is what we got, par excellence. So thanks again for a faultless Easter Monday programme.
Start the Week usually gets that sort of positive reaction, and usually it's live. However, the Easter Monday edition was pre-recorded, and unusually, copies of the programme were sent out to the press well before broadcast. News editors are always in want of a good religious news story at Easter, and some of those who listened to the preview tapes thought they'd found one. On Easter Saturday, 2 days before Start the Week was to be transmitted, this was broadcast.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, says the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland has lost all credibility because of the child abuse scandal. In an interview for Radio 4's Start the Week programme, to be broadcast on Easter Monday, Dr. Williams says Roman Catholicism in Ireland is in crisis.
It's quite difficult in some parts of Ireland to go down the street wearing a clerical collar now. And an institution so deeply bound in to the life of the society, suddenly losing all credibility. And that's not just a problem for the church, it is a problem for everybody in Ireland.
Well, that sounds clear and damning enough. But in fact, Dr. Williams was in part reporting the views of a friend. This is what he said immediately before the clip you heard.
And what about the other great Christian church in this country, the Catholic Church? You've had problems, but not on the scale they have at the moment, it has to be said, with the paedophile priest issue and so on.
It's been, I think, in Ireland especially, a colossal corporate trauma, hasn't it? Mm. And I was speaking to an Irish friend recently who was saying that it's quite difficult in some parts of Ireland to go down the street wearing a clerical collar now. And an institution so deeply...
Well, the news story appeared on bulletins throughout Easter Saturday and caused a huge amount of media comment and anger among the leadership of the Irish Catholic Church over the Easter weekend. It led to this apology from the Archbishop of Canterbury on Radio 2 on Sunday morning.
I didn't honestly think I was saying anything that had not been said by others about the Irish Church, including leaders of the Irish Church. I wasn't intending to criticise or condemn, but to point out a really tragic situation and a huge challenge that faces the Church in Ireland at the moment, which many of them are rising to with great courage. And I feel very sorry that anything I've said should be taken as undermining that. That was anything but my intention, especially at a time like this.
Of course, the actual programme was not broadcast until the following day, so it was impossible at first for listeners to hear the context in which Rowan Williams was speaking. When they did, many contacted feedback, among them Helen Casson.
On Easter Saturday, Radio 4 news programmes led with an item that was based on remarks that the Archbishop of Canterbury had recorded for the Start the Week programme on Easter Monday. And Robert Piggott, in his piece for the item, took remarks that the Archbishop made completely out of context and suggested that they had implications which certainly weren't there in the conversation as it was broadcast on the Monday.
Christine Protz, a listener from London, had similar feelings, but she had something else to add as well.
It was far from being a significant part of the programme, I felt, and it might be considered, perhaps, as Rowan Williams being naively honest. And it's a pity we can't accept this honesty without blowing it up out of all proportion. If this was reported because it was felt to be news, then I think it was a lazy way to obtain news. If it was thought to be a good way to publicise this programme, then it's left this listener now wondering about the motivation of the integrity of Start the Week.
Tom Dawkes from Cardiff sees this incident as part of a larger trend on Radio 4.
In my view, Radio 4 is far too fond of putting trailers for BBC programmes as news items.
Meanwhile, Margaret Healy-Pollitt from Birmingham has wider concerns.
An agenda to drive a wedge between different parts of the church in order to create sensationalist news. This is not neutral newscasting or balanced recording, and I expect better than this of the BBC.
Craig Oliver is the deputy head of the BBC newsroom. I began our interview by asking him how extracts from Start the Week had made their way to air before the programme itself was transmitted.
Well, it's not uncommon for a programme to be recorded several days in advance of it actually being broadcast, but I can understand that the audience might find it slightly strange.
But in this instance, the programme was recorded, I understand, just over a week before it was transmitted, the Andrew Marr programme. How were you alerted to what you thought was the story?
The process was that late on the Friday night, there was a newswire that came out reporting the story. And that newswire appears to have actually come from the front page of the Times, the Saturday Times.
And they they got the story, what, because a tape of Start the Week had been sent to them for preview?
You'll have to ask the BBC press office about what happened or the makers of the programme about that. But as far as news was concerned, we basically were aware of the story late on the Friday night and we decided to check it out. And at 11:15 on that night, Robert Piggott, our religious affairs correspondent, looked into the story. He got hold of the tape of the relevant sections of the programme, listened to it, and there was a discussion about whether or not we thought this was a news story that deserved to be run.
And it's not a case of Andrew Marr doing the interview, ringing up and saying, "Hey, I've got a cracking interview here, there's a real news line. By the way, it'll do good for in terms of trailing my programme." Andrew Marr had nothing to do with alerting you.
No, that certainly didn't happen with the BBC. The way we discovered it was through, I think it was the AFP wire service were reporting it, and of course the Times newspaper, which you actually see late at night on the Friday, which is for the Saturday.
Now, there's a potential problem here, isn't there, where you take a clip like this before the programme's transmitted, because if a clip is taken out of context, the audience can't go to, say, listen again, or can't listen to the programme live and say, "Oh, well, I understand what the Archbishop was saying. Yes, that's a slight exaggeration." They have to wait 2 days to know whether or not you've used a clip out of context. In those circumstances, is there a danger in running the news clip ahead of the programme being transmitted?
I think that there can be a danger in running the news clip ahead of what's happened. The key issue is, are we actually across that, and are we actually behaving in a responsible and impartial manner? When I've spoken to the people who reported it and spoken to Robert Piggott, I'm confident that they basically looked at the story and were careful to make sure that everybody understood the proper context in which it was said.
Well, as you know, a lot of our listeners don't think that, and they think you're being unfair to a man who's trying to be open and honest and relatively sophisticated in what he says, and that you've used a section of it to give a misleading impression. And they question, first of all, the accuracy of what you said. The news said they used the past tense, talking about Rowan Williams. He's claimed that the church had lost all credibility, referring to the church in Ireland. You listen to it, and he doesn't say it in the past tense, lost. He says losing, which of course is a transitional process.
The quote that I wrote down from listening to the programme today was talking about had lost all credibility. I wrote that down this morning.
I've just listened to it myself, and the actual quote, it's correct on your website, it says, "And an institution so deeply bound into the life of a society, suddenly losing all credibility." That's not just a problem for the church, it's a problem for everybody in Ireland. He says losing very clearly there, yet the reports say the past tense, lost. There is a difference. So in that sense, it was an incorrect quote.
I think what's important here is, are we actually reporting substantially what Rowan Williams said? And actually, did we play clips from the programme where you actually heard what Rowan Williams said? And yes, we did. Now, the issue here is, did the reporting in terms of the introductions and the headlines substantively change what he meant and what he said? I'm not sure that that is the case. I do think that there is an issue here, and I take very seriously what the listeners are saying in this case, is that when you have a headline or when you have a news report, you inevitably make things briefer and sharper. There is one issue that I would like to say that we did make a mistake on, and we did correct that. There was one bulletin on one of the radio services where we said that we didn't make clear that Rowan Williams was talking about a friend that had spoken to him. We very quickly realised that was the case. There was quite a bit of email traffic in the minutes after the bulletin, and we corrected that immediately, and that was a mistake, and that shouldn't have happened.
So you did, to that extent, take it out of context by not making it clear in one of your bulletins that Dr. Williams was referring to what he'd been told by a friend in Ireland. You acknowledged that was a mistake.
I think in that one bulletin it certainly was a mistake. What you've got to understand is there's a huge amount of BBC content across the piece. That was one bulletin out of a lot of coverage, and we did make a mistake in that bulletin. The key question, I think, about that quote as well is, I think it's a subsection of what he was saying. Was it actually substantively the main point of what he was saying? It was part of it, but not totally. And were listeners substantively misled? I don't think that that was the case.
Well, as you'll know from having read the emails, that's not the view of some of our listeners who think they were misled and that the Archbishop was taken out of context. But perhaps they make a larger point, which is this. It's okay with politicians, perhaps, to use short slugs of what they say, because politicians are in the business of headlines. When you're talking about an Archbishop of Canterbury, try to be frank and open and discuss seriously things. To take such short headlines out is often to misrepresent what he's trying to do. And if you're an archbishop, and if you get hammered like this, as he will probably think he was and his supporters do, he'll be tempted to either speak only in tabloid headlines or to withdraw from the public debate. And a lot of our listeners think that would be a major loss.
One of the things that I'm aware of, having listened to and looked at some of the concerns of the audience, is that they know that Rowan Williams is a very thoughtful man, and he's very careful about the language which he uses. And I think when you listen to what he said, he was very careful about the language that he used. He also knew that he was going on a programme that was going to be discussing this contentious issue, and he's also aware of the fact that that may have been used for news purposes. So I don't think he was misled in that sense, and it then comes back to the point of, did we as BBC News actually mislead the audience? And I think we did make one mistake, but actually, in the round, it was very clear what he said, and he hasn't complained about how we treated him. Lambeth Palace has not complained about how we treated him. And also, Rowan Williams apologised for what he said. And it's very important, I think, that you look at the apology that he made. He didn't actually apologise for being misquoted. He didn't apologise for what he said. He apologised for whether or not he'd caused any upset. So he didn't actually withdraw what he said in that apology.
Now, some of our listeners would probably think he's apologising for the way the BBC reported what he said. But, I mean, the crucial thing, I think others would say, the lesson of this is that if you really want to fully inform your audience, you shouldn't take clips out of a programme until it's broadcast, because then they can hear what you say in the news bulletin. If they want, they can either listen to the programme live or they can go to listen again. When you use clips 2-3 days ahead of transmission, they can't place it in context.
I want to take you up on your point that he was possibly apologising for the way the BBC reported him. In no sense is that the case, and I think if you look at Rowan Williams' apology, in no sense is that the case. I think that your point is, do we need to be careful when we do this kind of thing? Do we need to be careful in any circumstances when we're taking a clip of what somebody is saying? Absolutely we do. And I think that the audience have raised some very interesting questions about that, particularly about something when somebody's being thoughtful. I come back, though, to the point, was Rowan Williams treated in such a way that the audience didn't understand actually what he was saying? I don't think that's the case.
Craig Oliver, Deputy Head of the BBC Newsroom. And if you want to make a point about that interview or anything else which concerns BBC Radio, please email us at feedback@bbc.co.uk. You can also call us on 03 333 444 544. Standard landline charges apply, but it will be more expensive on some mobile networks. Letters can be sent to Feedback, PO Box 2100, London W1A1QT, and the details can also be found on our pages on the Radio 4 website. Over the Easter break, many listeners took great pleasure in listening to Radio 4's Counterpoint Music Quiz, hosted by Paul Gambaccini.
Now part of an overture, not perhaps as well known as the three-movement suite with which it shares its name, although this tune is heard in the first part of the suite. Can you tell me the name of the overture?
After hearing Counterpoint, a joyous Pauline Porter from East Sussex got in touch.
Bravo indeed for the delightfully entertaining Easter Counterpoint. It was one of those rare, for me, stop-everything-and-just-listen moments. I feel that Paul Gambaccini has already raised the programme to new heights since taking the chair, and tonight's programme reached another pinnacle. And the only improvement I might suggest is that it was disappointing not to hear the slower and faster music played at the right tempo afterwards. But obviously time is a factor. So thank you for a brilliant piece of broadcasting.
Now, we've managed to get this far in the programme without mentioning the election campaign. But I guess you knew it couldn't last. As ever, the Today programme is one of the major battlegrounds, and on Thursday morning, John Humphreys interviewed Prime Minister Gordon Brown, as was to be expected. With the economy such a major electoral topic, the origins of the banking crisis was one of the subjects covered.
I was saying all the time that we had a global economic system, a global financial system. Unless you could supervise it globally, then we would be bound to have a problem that would arise.
You wanted risk-based regulatory approach. You congratulated the city on taking risks. You wanted to enhance that. You said, don't want just a light touch, but a limited touch.
What we wanted was those organisations and companies that have proved themselves to be resilient not to have a huge high-touch regulation on them, but those of the companies that had proved that they were couldn't get things right, we would have a heavy touch regulation. That was the way we wanted to do the system.
But you weren't looking at them carefully enough to see whether they were getting it right or not.
But John, look, what happened? It started with people taking subprime mortgages in America. They were registered AAA when they were sold to Britain.
It wasn't just America. It was happening here. People were borrowing 110% of the value of their home. They were borrowing seven times their income.
And we have stopped that
now. Yeah, but too late.
We have stopped too late.
Andrew Harrison from London is one of many who contacted us following those exchanges.
John Humphrey's interview with Gordon Brown on this morning's Today programme was hectoring, badgering and infuriating. What is the point of getting the Prime Minister on your programme if you're not going to let him get a word in edgeways? There is a general election on, and there are countless issues which urgently need to be explored. Instead, we got John Humphrey searching for a gotcha moment. It was all noise and no illumination.
The announcement of the election itself provoked a large flurry of comment. Brian Denham got in touch from Devon.
Why was it necessary to extend the World at One on Tuesday, April the 6th? Is the coming month of electioneering not long enough that we have to rush in with an extra hour or so?
Peter Gordon from Bournemouth wonders how much demand there is for all this election news.
How about the BBC polling the listeners by text or email to see whether 4 more weeks of this is really wanted? I wonder whether anyone other than presenters and their guests are really enjoying themselves.
Despite this apparent lack of appetite for extended election coverage, the extra political nourishment will be placed on the already groaning table. Louise Adamson has been in the heat of the BBC election kitchen to find out more.
The headlines this morning. Gordon Brown is to announce today that the general election...
The World at One. This is Martha Carney with a special hour-long programme on the day Gordon Brown confirmed...
Tonight, live interviews with William Hague, Ed Miliband and Sir Mingus Campbell. And later in the programme...
The 6th of April 2010. Gordon Brown has been to the palace and announced the date of the general election. And Radio 4's coverage of the campaign is in full swing. So how are they planning to bring us all the political twists and turns of the next few weeks?
We are now walking into what I'm calling the election bunker, which is in the very basement of Television Centre.
Rupert Allman is Radio 4's election editor. We're in one of the crucial areas for the network's coverage of the campaign.
So what you see in front of you here, quiet, but in the white heat of an election night, there'll be any number of things going on here.
Of course, we've got a while before election night, so what's Radio 4 planning for the next few weeks?
We've got a number of things in the pipeline, so the schedule is going to change to reflect the campaign. There'll be programmes like What the Election Papers Say. There's a programme with Clive Anderson called The Heckler, which is very much a kind of sideways view about what's going on in the campaign. And then there's the Vote Now show as well, which will kind of, you know, up the pace with regard to what's going on between now and a polling day as well.
The World at One will be extended to run for a full hour throughout the campaign, and on some days will include election call, which allows listeners to put their questions to the politicians. Jamie Angus is the programme's editor.
World at One has a really important place in the day, which is that we're far enough on through the day's campaigning to identify what the key stories are going to be. And we can start to work out what facts and context and illustration the audience need around each story to help them understand the big campaigning stories of the day.
Although, of course, maybe a message for the feedback listeners, because you are taking our Friday slot.
With great regret, yes, but I'm happy to hear that feedback will still be on the air, and I very much expect that you'll continue to come back and visit us during the course of the campaign if listeners have observations about the way we're covering the election.
Of course, there's one thing about this election which seems likely to set it apart from any that's gone before.
I'm looking at Twitter at the moment. I've got a whole list of political tweeters.
Rory Coughlan-Jones is the BBC's digital election correspondent.
I can see a Conservative MP, I can see a Labour MP, some Labour bloggers, and they're all trying to get their message out, and they're also...
So how will the explosion in the internet since the last election make this one different?
Well, the difference from 2005 is the arrival of what we call social media, things like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, where people are going online, having a conversation online. And the political parties have seen that happening and have said, hey, we want to be part of that conversation. So they're all trying to work out how they can use those new media tools to connect with voters.
So this plethora of information floating around on the internet, is that not going to make it incredibly difficult to cover the election campaign because there's just so much out there?
I think what it is going to do is accelerate the election campaign even more. We've had the 24-hour news era. Now we've got the 24-second, as it were, Twitter, Facebook era. So if somebody makes a gaffe, it'll be instantly visible, it will be instantly analysed, it'll spread very quickly.
And of course, there's something else new this time round, as Rupert Orman explains.
The prime ministerial debates, you'll have the opportunity to listen to them as well as watch them. So if you're not near a television, on Radio 4, you will hear the prime ministerial debates, all three of them. They are 90 minutes each. The programme is being presented on radio by Robin Lustig. And because it's so close, they've got the possibility of being real game changers.
But what about those feedback listeners who feel they've been hearing too much about the election? How would World at One editor Jamie Angus answer their objections to the extended coverage?
Clearly, every time you make a change to a network format, some members of the audience will like it and some won't. You know, I've got another email from the World at One inbox that I received yesterday lunchtime that says, I do wish we could have a full hour's worth of news and comment every lunchtime. People shouldn't worry that there will only be election coverage in the extended World at One. We'll continue to do the usual mix of stories, world news stories, other non-politics stories that we do every day, and also some of the lighter moments, some of the things that Martha brings to the programme and so on. But for people who are very interested in the election, and to be honest, a lot of the Radio 4 audience are, despite some of the comments you've had, they will be able to get the in-depth coverage that they need at lunchtime.
And Rupert Orman echoes this determination to bring all the news of the election campaign to listeners over the next few weeks.
This is a great story. It's an important story. It's also a story which is rare in news. We just don't know the outcome. I think it's part of also responding to the demand that we have from the audience, who says when there is a really big, important news story, and this is one, we expect Radio 4 to up its game to respond to that. And I hope we'll do at least some of that, if not all of it, between now and polling day.
Rupert Orman ending that report by Louise Adamson. The white supremacist and passionate supporter of the apartheid regime in South Africa, Eugene Terblanche, held views which the majority of people find abhorrent, and his violent death will not have come as a total surprise to many. His brutal murder, he was beaten to death, was widely reported in the Sunday papers that are regularly reviewed on Radio 4's Broadcasting House, which was presented last week by Kevin Connolly. Two of the guests reviewing the papers were The Guardian's Marina Hyde and comedian Omid Jalili.
I have to say, when I knew I was coming on a programme like this, it's a gift from God to have one of the world's greatest white supremacists be killed. And in fact, apparently Jacob Zuma was said today, we're very, very sad to hear of the passing of Eugene... Oh, I can't keep a straight face!
You know, he's appealing for calm, I think, in the news.
He's appealing for calm, but I mean, when Winston Churchill died, if you remember, all of the cranes of London were pointing towards the funeral cortege, I think, in South Africa. Do you remember Half Mast? I think when Eugene Terreblanche is going to be taken through the streets of South Africa, all the crane drivers will be told to go back to their own countries, wherever that is. I mean, that's basically what's going to happen.
Yes, he was. He was still alive when the police found him in his remote farm. So I suppose at least you can say it was slow.
It was very slow.
Many listeners were repelled by what they saw as unseemly gloating over the barbarous killing. One such was Russell Middleton.
However repugnant were Mr. Terreblanche's views, the host and his guests would have done well to remember they were discussing a man who was brutally hacked to death. Making light of his murder, or even celebrating it, as Omid and Marino appeared to do, is a dereliction of respect for the sanctity of human life.
David Boorer also got in touch.
Do these people think that a violent death is somehow a good thing? Do they keep a list of those they think merit such an end, so that they can smugly laugh at some deaths and weep for others? They should have been stopped or corrected immediately this morning. Were the presenter and producer and editor asleep? How do they think, for example, that their remarks, were they to be broadcast in South Africa, would have promoted the cause of peace and harmony?
We contacted the Broadcasting House programme and passed over these critical comments. We were given this response.
We knew Omid Jalili wanted to reflect on newspaper stories covering the death of Eugene Terreblanche, but not what he intended to say. We are sorry some listeners found his remarks, as well as those of Marina Hyde, uncomfortable listening. In a live discussion, it's difficult for the presenter to judge if and how to intervene, especially when dealing with what were clearly honestly held opinions. In retrospect, we all agree it would have been helpful to steer the discussion back to the newspaper contents.
Before we close, let me tell you that we'll be placing our item about the news coverage of the Archbishop of Canterbury on the Radio 4 blog. Please feel free to post your comments over there, as well as contacting us over here. Thanks for listening to Feedback. For the duration of the election, due to the extended editions of The World at One, which we reported earlier, we will no longer be going out on Friday lunchtimes. But the Sunday 8 p.m. transmission remains unaffected, so do please keep your comments coming. In the meantime, we'll end with a request from listener Jeff Blint from Watford.
I just heard Jazza singing on the Arches, and I had to listen to it over 3 times. I'm completely blown away by his voice. And may we hear the full version of the song from the episode, please?
Well, Mr. Blint, it's really pick of the week's territory, but seeing as many others wrote in with the same request, we're happy on this occasion to oblige, at least in part. From the Archers, this is Jazza with The Roses of Prince Charlie. Goodbye.
Come now, gather now, here where the flowers grow white is the blossom as the snow on the bend. Hear now freedom's call, we'll make a solemn vow now by the roses o' Prince Charlie. Ride again at Bannock from your battle axe to wheel, ride away your grandsires on Flodden's bloody field, by the Culloden, the bonny Prince.